The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
This meeting of our Public Accounts Committee meeting to order. Today we have with us the Auditor General to discuss the June 2016 report of the Auditor General. There are three chapters in the report. We will begin with introductions, starting with Mr. McGuire.
Brendan McGuire, Halifax Atlantic. Good morning.
Good morning. MLA Suzanne Lonas-Croft, Lunenburg.
Chuck Porter, Hans West.
Good morning. Good morning. Keith Irving, King South, filling in for MLA Ian Rankin.
Good morning. My name is Tim Houston. I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning. Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
And I'm Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness, your chair. Mr. Pickup, please introduce yourself and Ms. Coleman-Sadd.
Good morning. Michael Pickup, Auditor General of Nova Scotia.
Good morning, Evangeline Coleman-Sadd, Assistant Auditor General.
And Mr. Pickup, please proceed with some opening comments.
Thank you for the opportunity today to talk about our spring report, which includes three audits. We just briefed the Public Accounts Committee in a one-hour session, so our opening comments will be fairly short. One of our audit reports in this report relates to the health authorities and the Department of Health and Wellness's management of its 41 hospitals and health care centres from an efficiency and effectiveness lens. We also looked at the identification and management of health and safety risks in homes for special care. There are 10,000 Nova Scotians in homes for special care, with the two departments spending on an annual basis approximately $774 million to provide these homes. These are some of the most vulnerable Nova Scotians. Finally, the last audit we looked at was species at risk and the management of and conservation and recovery of species at risk by the Department of Natural Resources. In Nova Scotia, there are approximately 60 species at risk. This is everything from wood turtles and snapping turtles to the Canadian lynx to the Atlantic whitefish. Our ecosystem depends upon a diversity of species, which impacts our economy, tourism, industry, etc. Within these three audits, we made 16 recommendations, and we'll be now happy to take questions from members on the three audits.
Thank you, Mr. Pickup. We will start with Mr. Houston for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report says that the health services planning is something that's been started and stopped a number of times over the past 20 years. Has it ever been completed, the whole review of what services should be delivered where, or has it just been started and stopped in an incomplete fashion?
Mr. Pickup.
So in this audit, we wouldn't have anything to report in terms of a complete plan having been put in place, so therefore the need for a plan to look at usage, location, and operation of hospitals and centres across the province.
Okay, so the number of, when staff said over the last 20 years this has been started a bunch of times, it's nobody produced something to you that said, and here's what they said back in 1998 or anything, you just didn't see anything like that?
There may have been various aspects of planning done. We didn't do a specific audit of hospital planning, but certainly no plan at a comprehensive point that would consider, for example, the 41 hospitals and centers across the province.
Okay. So there's a plan underway now, the department has indicated. Did they give you any indication to your staff as to when that one would be completed, when the plan for what services should be delivered and should be delivered where and stuff? Do you?
So in the, we made a recommendation that they should develop a plan, and the response to that is on page 33 of the report, which indicates that, of course, they agree with the report and that this engagement with Nova Scotians is going to take a variety of forms, and that they need to engage stakeholders to develop a systems and services of quality, sustainable, patient-centered care. But within that, there is no date on when this will be based.
No date, okay. And it wasn't a recommendation of yours as to when that should be completed by?
So we didn't put an end date on it because really that would presume that, you know, we are running the healthcare system.
Sure, and they didn't offer an end date.
So there's in the response there is no end date.
Okay, that's fine on that. Okay, but I do take from your point, from your report, that it's important that planning be done where services should be delivered, and they should be communicated to Nova Scotians. And we do know that just in April there was an announcement about the VG. Now, I recognize that April 2016 announcement would fall out of your audit period, but I am curious as to your thoughts on just kind of whether the substance of that announcement might have met your recommendation, because the government, as part of that announcement, announced that it would be that some services at the VG would start to move to other healthcare facilities, and it specifically mentioned Dartmouth General as being a place that services could be moved to. And the only price tag referred to in that announcement at that time was the fifth floor expansion at Dartmouth General. At the same time, I was interested in that because in this report indicates that Dartmouth General had a leaky roof which damaged newly renovated space on the floor below it. So we have the government saying we're going to move some services to this facility. We have the Auditor General saying there's infrastructure problems at that facility. And I'm just wondering if you had any thoughts on whether the Dartmouth General would be ready to take on the added pressure of some of these services from the VG.
So the recommendation we made was to have a detailed plan in place and share that with Nova Scotians. The Department of Health and Wellness in their response have indicated that planning will be continued to be shared, and they list a variety of ways that they're going to share this. Details, for example, of what will have to be done at any of the locations was not part of this audit. That this was really at that initial stage of identifying that something had to be done. And, of course, the announcement on April 21st came subsequent to the audit mm-hmm. period as well.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just interested in the part where we have to communicate openly and fairly with Nova Scotians, and to make a statement like some of these things are going to happen that then we see in Auditor General's report that kind of seems to be at odds with that. It just causes me a bit of concern, because you call very specifically for clear and timely information about the new VG project. So in that sense, and knowing what we just found out about the Dartmouth General from your report here, were you able to find anything during the course of your audit that would have showed any concrete planning, costing, timelines about what might happen to some of the services at the VG, or was there just nothing in the audit period that suggested anyone was looking at costing out how some of these things were going to happen and whether or not some of the things that they're saying could happen could actually happen? Did you see anything in your audit that said people are actually digging into this?
So the audit definitely did not look at sort of the feasibility of a plan or, you know, how comprehensive a plan was, how well that was prepared. This really was about the identification of the need to deal with the facility. So, you know, and some of those additional questions you're asking, I think, are good questions that could be posed to departmental and health authority officials in the meantime before we actually follow up on the recommendations in 2 years.
Okay. I guess it kind of just struck me as communicating with Nova Scotia is important, but communicating prematurely with really no substance below what you're communicating is probably not going to meet the recommendation that you've made. So I do want to kind of continue to explore that a little bit with the, in terms of, you looked at some of the congestion in emergency rooms and identified some causes for that congestion. And one of those causes was that if people can't get to a doctor, they turn up at an emergency room if they're not able to schedule an appointment with a family doctor or whatever the case may be. And we do know that there's many Nova Scotians that are looking for a doctor, that are in need of a family doctor, that are without a family doctor at the moment. And, you know, we've had a lot of talk right in this very house here about the some of the campaign promises that were dangled in front of people, that they promised that everyone would have a doctor. And then when I... there's a comment in the report here that a doctor for every Nova Scotian may not be feasible. And I did want to explore that a little bit because it continues the same theme of making premature announcements that are impossible to substantiate. So I did want to ask you specifically about the finding in your report at 2.20 where it says it may not be feasible for every Nova Scotian to have a doctor. Can you maybe elaborate on what might be behind that statement?
Sure. So that may reflect the reality that all Nova Scotians may not have a doctor, and then alternative solutions need to be found, like the CECs, for example, where there may be a variety of people housed in a location. So, you know, this audit was not about the details of physician planning in terms of how well that is being done. That would sort of be a separate audit, if you will. But again, this was sort of the context of when we visited 19 hospitals across the province and we talked to people about why emergency rooms are crowded. Or why people have to wait long. Some of the responses we received on these visits were things like people saying they don't have a doctor, or people don't want to wait for an appointment with their doctor, or people are looking at emergency rooms as an outpatient service. So these were really about some explanations that were provided as to why this issue. So our recommendation is really the health authority and the department, they need to uncover these underlying issues and then determine how do we deal with these underlying issues.
So in the course of the audit, when these discussions are coming up with staff about, you know, people are turning up here because they don't have a doctor and stuff, did any staff provide or offer or volunteer any analysis of what the cost to the overall system might be because of the shortage of doctors? I guess that wouldn't have been really in the scope here.
So, no, we weren't looking at a quantification. What we were looking at is there an understanding and acceptance that there are underlying issues that are causing the wait times in emergency rooms and the overcrowding? And there isn't an acknowledgement through the audit that, yes, there's an understanding that there are some issues. And now comes the sort of critical part of addressing the recommendation and dealing with these underlying issues so as to fix what may be a symptom of other problems, i.e. the wait times in the emergency rooms and the crowding.
Okay, thank you. I think it presents a frightening picture for Nova Scotians where we say the existing model is not sustainable, but it's not feasible to have a doctor. It's gonna take some real intelligence to figure this out, I guess. But in terms of another aspect of the emergency room overcrowding, was that there are patients in hospital beds, that are looking for, that are waiting for alternative care, and that is kind of, that's something I hear about a lot. Did you have anything in your audit that suggested across the province, or at least in the 19 hospitals you looked at, as to how many people are in beds that are waiting for an alternative level of care?
So, firstly, recognizing that when we visited the 19 hospitals, which is 19 out of 41 facilities under the health authority's control, is that this was explained as one of the reasons. We didn't attempt to sort of quantify the cost of that or all of the numbers. We do acknowledge or recognize in the report that it's fairly accepted that a day in the hospital, maybe $1,300, a day in a long-term care facility is probably $250. But these organizations are also looking for other options, right? It's not just necessarily long-term care. It may be community care, it may be home care as well. And we did note an example where one of the hospitals had a project underway to try and keep people in their home and have them move from their home to long-term care when it was necessary without sort of that stop in the hospital for a long period of time that may not have been necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But you didn't know how many people were in the hospital that were waiting for alternative care, and then what was the average length of stay? Those weren't statistics that would have been picked up as part of the audit.
The department may have that information and probably do, so you may want to pose that question to them. What we were trying to do is present a broader sense of some of the issues and get acknowledgement that there are issues which may be impacting emergency, like the lack of a bed due to things like people waiting for a long-term care facility.
Okay. In terms of mental health, you recommend that the government work with partners to provide mental health care and adult protection. Can you just explain a little bit about what behind that recommendation?
Sure. So the recommendation indicated that for patients who may require mental health care services that go to emergency rooms, for example, it may be that they need to be treated in the emergency room, or it may be that they require a different level of care, something that is not happening in the emergency room that may be more appropriate for them. Emergency rooms obviously can be fairly hectic, lots of machines, lots of noise, lots of emergencies happening that may not be the best environment for somebody with issues of a mental health nature. So what we were indicating is that there's acknowledgement that needs to be examined to see not only from an efficiency perspective, but also the best level of care for those patients.
So shortly after that was discussed as part of this audit, up to March 31st, shortly after, within a couple months in August, the department closed the mental health short stay unit at the Aberdeen in Pictou County, which to me seems exactly the opposite of what your recommendation was saying they should be doing. The emergency room is not the appropriate place for people in these crises. And then we have the department responds to you saying, yes, we're looking at working with other partners and other things, and then turn around and close a short stay unit. It just seems so far at odds for me with I don't know if the word is placating or whatever, but they're playing along with you, and then turn around as soon as you leave the room, they do something different. So I don't know if you can speak to that at all.
Well, I think what I would comment on that is this wasn't an audit focused solely on the effectiveness of the delivery of mental health care services to Nova Scotians. But we would acknowledge that this is a significant area, and we have decided that we will do a standalone audit of the effectiveness of mental health care services to patients across Nova Scotia, in Nova Scotia, including children. So the health authority will be included in that audit, as will the IWK, as will the Department of Health. So that will give us a chance to have a more in-depth look at issues surrounding how effective mental health services are being delivered to Nova Scotians.
Okay. Well, I think that's a worthwhile thing because, again, the audit period was up to March 31st. Right around that time, the budget would have been tabled. So we had the department saying we're going to look at ways for working with other with partners. And right around that time, the budget's coming down, and there's cuts to the eating disorders, and there's cuts to, you know, schizophrenia association and stuff. So I think it's a good area to follow up on for sure, because definitely that's to me the right hand saying something and the left hand doing something completely different, and all to the detriment of Nova Scotians. So that's a good area to look at, and I appreciate you doing that. How are we for time, Mr. Chair?
You have until 10:24.
Okay. I think with a couple minutes left, I would start with the homes for special care. And I do want to explore the finding that there's no service, there's no signed service provider agreements, which is pretty frightening to me. And it is something that I had been looking at as well, because... But maybe you could explain what a signed service provider agreement might look like if one existed.
So some examples of what might be in a signed service agreement would include what do you expect for level of service, for quality of service. So really outlining the expectations that you who are paying the bill on behalf of these vulnerable Nova Scotians expect, so that you can hold the parties providing this service to account. At the end of the day, community services, for example, in 15-16 will spend $253 million on homes for special care. Not to have signed service agreements to hold these parties accountable for what they deliver, I think is a deficiency that needs to be addressed, and therefore the recommendation. Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually those signed agreements would protect the service providers as well, because I do know that I have a lot of people approach me that have a loved one in a special, you know, home for special care, and maybe got just a notice, well, we're discharging your loved one tomorrow, because there's no contract that says they have to give any time. There's no signed agreements there. And then when you dig into it, you find out that maybe the home was saying to the department, you know, we're having trouble caring for this person, and not hearing anything back from the department, because there's, again, no timelines, and the department just out of sight, out of mind. And then ultimately it gets to a boiling point where the home says, this person's out. And it's creating a lot of stress and crises on families. So I think that, I'm sure that's the types of things that should be in an agreement, as when the termination of care is and some of these clauses around that. Is that kind of what you had in mind?
And I think what would be important is, from a risk perspective, that both parties agree what should be covered off within the service agreements. I think it would probably be hard for Nova Scotians to understand how you spend $253 million without having signed service agreements, so that, you know, you're the one cutting the checks, you're the one looking after these 2,300 people, that you're getting what you're paying for, essentially, to keep it simple.
I'm holding up a pencil right now. I'm sure the province wouldn't buy 2,000 pencils without putting it for tender and signing a contract on it. And yet we have, as you say, all these people in the care with nothing written down. It's highly insulting. In terms of the, I guess maybe...
Yeah, your time has almost expired, Mr. Okay. Houston. Okay, so we'll move to Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. I want to pick up, I think, from where my colleague started off, and I think it was chapter two. And there's clear indication that a plan is needed. I think you somewhat answered the question, but in your opinion, what kind of timeline? I know you said you didn't give a timeline, but is there an expectation if you're doing an audit like this and you said a plan is needed, what an appropriate amount of time would be to come up with a plan to address some of the needs, especially in healthcare? So could you indicate, do you have a timeline in mind on how long it should take to come up to address come up with a plan to address some of the issues that you've identified in your audit?
Mr. Pickup.
So, firstly, I would indicate that we follow up generally recommendations 2 years. So, generally, we say after 2 years, a recommendation should be addressed. In this case, I think, you know, really it's up to legislators, including the Public Accounts Committee, to hold the health authority and the department accountable to this, to say, you know, on behalf of the Nova Scotians we represent, we would expect, I mean, we know the Auditor General won't be back for 2 years, but we would expect a plan to be developed, you know, whether you feel it's in a year. Everybody acknowledges this is 40% of the provincial budget, or a little bit more. This has to be one of the most key recommendations and key priorities to act upon. So while we're not going to be back for 2 years, I would suggest that this plan should be in place well before the 2 years, and would encourage the Public Accounts Committee to bring in officials from the department and health authority, and, you know, sort of get a deadline and talk to them about what you think a reasonable timeline is to put this in place.
And it's interesting that we didn't need your audit to agree, and the current government didn't need your audit to agree that a plan was needed. From day one, when the current government took over, that was at the thrust of their commitment, was to change how health care is delivered. And here we are 2.5 years, almost 3 years into their mandate, and they've been talking about a plan for that whole time. It's been frustrating to try to get some of the information from the government, but I hope that they don't take the audit that was just done, that they have another 2 years to come up with a plan. Yeah, I think that's too long. I think Nova Scotians expect better from the government. It's interesting, some of the indications and examples that you used on how we need to do things differently in healthcare. Interesting enough, were implemented pretty quickly. Collaborative emergency centers. A plan was put in place within 2 years, year and a half, of the former government. And those collaborative emergency centers, I believe there was 8 open within 4-year period. A plan was provided. Implementation of a change on how to improve healthcare in Nova Scotia. And it's interesting that you spent some time reviewing that, indicating that that was a positive thing. Home First program, another program that was implemented by previous government. The current government changed the name. It was Home Again, but Home First, I guess they needed a name change to put their brand on it. But it's interesting to see that we're 2.5, almost 3 years into their mandate, and I don't see any examples of how things are being done differently in healthcare to improve services for Nova Scotians or access to services. You indicated you visited 19 hospitals out of 41. During those visits, did you witness or did you see needed repairs that needed to be done and in an urgent fashion in those 19 hospitals?
So during our visit to 19 hospitals, which I would point out were 9 of the regional hospitals and then 9 community-based supporting the regional hospitals as well as the QE2, we provide examples in the report, and not to suggest that's a complete list. It is some of the examples that were shared with us, and not to suggest the priority of these items. But what we're trying to do is point out to Nova Scotians through this report and to committees like yours, some of the examples that were given to us. So in some cases, it may be sprinkler systems. In other cases, elevators or bricks falling off of a building. But again, that was not meant to be a complete and exhaustive list, or not to suggest that those were the priorities to be addressed, because those are decisions for people running the organizations.
Yeah. But so I mean, really the question is, and I think the answer is yes, there's a need. I think in your chart on page 35, you show that there's a need for hospital infrastructure spending. And it's interesting, over the last 3 years, you indicated there's about $114 million needed in urgent infrastructure funding Last year, funding available was about $29 million. The government underspent hospital infrastructure by $26.8 million last year alone. I mean, how can you justify underspending that amount of money in an area that your office has indicated needs $114 million in urgent infrastructure funding? I mean, is there any, in your mind, any justification on underspending that budget line item year after year, as we've seen over the last 3 years?
So I think what is critical is that there are these identified infrastructure needs. But more importantly, I think, in collaboration with that, there needs to be a look at the inventory of hospitals for development of a plan for the location, use, and operation. So we give an example in here where there are four hospitals, for example, in Cape Breton, where three of them are located within a 30-minute drive of the regional hospital. Some of those hospitals have significant infrastructure needs. You know, one as high as $13 million in the last report. What we're indicating is look at your inventory of 41 facilities and figure out what you actually need, where, what it needs to do, what you need to do with that where, and what people can expect. Engage people in that discussion and share with them before the historical way of simply trying to address all of the infrastructure needs that may exist, when that may not fit into your overall plan of what you're going to do with these facilities. So the plan, seems to me, needs to come first and needs to be quick, and then everything else after that should fall out of an overall comprehensive plan as to what you want where and how you're going to use it.
And I would agree. I would agree with you. But would you not think 3 years, almost 3 years, would it be adequate? I mean, we look at 70, I'm trying to find my figure here, 70-some million dollars, $73.4 million in the last 3 years underspent in infrastructure, hospital infrastructure. Would you not think after the first year that that work would have been identified by the government in need of hopefully putting an urgency on it to come up with that plan? And that's the frustration, I think, staff and patients often have because of the conditions of their hospital. So would you not think 3 years is adequate time to come forward with a plan, or are we expecting maybe another 2 years before a plan would come in place? I mean, I would think that first year of underspending the hospital budget, you would have started looking at your inventory and say, okay, let's prioritize this. Let's spend the money that we're allocating, that we're promising Nova Scotians that we were going to spend in a fiscal year. Would you not think 3 years is enough time to come up with that plan?
So we picked this audit to do, you know, a year ago, based on our risk assessment and our thought process of what's important to Nova Scotians. And it was clear to us that there's a lot of discussion about infrastructure needs at various hospitals from one end of the province to the other. So when we got into it and started doing this audit work, well, we came in, you know, we came to the point that this is not simply about, you know, spending money to fix all of your inventory and look after everything. It really is about a more comprehensive plan to say, okay, let's get this done. So all I can really speak to is to say, you know, 1 year ago, you know, we thought this was important enough to do an audit on. This was a big audit we did. We visited 19 hospitals. We're pretty clear what we think is needed, including the discussion and engagement with Nova Scotians. And so the recommendations are as they are.
I mean, and I understand, you know, your 2.32 on page 35, the proximity of facilities. Can I understand that? But some of the examples you use were in regional hospitals, which by no means do I think the government will ever look at saying we can't do repairs on that hospital because we might close that down the road. I don't foresee the current government or any future government closing a regional hospital. So you used an example of South Shore Regional Hospital, the Dartmouth General Hospital electrical system. One here that I didn't hear about, we hear much about VG and the Centennial Building and the leaks, but one had a leaky roof at Dartmouth General that caused an issue on a renovated floor below. Would you not think that those examples are ones that should have seen an investment where we should see an underspent in a line item in the budget? Or really is the bottom line of getting back to balance and having a balanced budget, you know, is that, to me, I see that as a priority for the government, not the examples that you use for infrastructure deficiency. So would you not think that those examples alone warrant that investment? You don't really need a plan to say you're committed to the Dartmouth General or the South Shore Regional, right?
It may be, and that could be a good discussion with the department and with the health authority, but it may be that that could be part of a comprehensive plan. But, you know, let's face it, what we're saying is that plan needs to be done now. It hasn't been done. It's needed. The observation is there. The recommendation is agreed to as well. And if you take, for example, the VG site, you know, we were doing this audit and up to a period of time before that announcement was made. We were pretty clear in the report that, to your point, we understand through these 19 visits that the condition of these facilities is causing challenges for the staff who work in the facilities. They're working in challenging conditions. You know, if you're dealing with Legionella, if you're dealing with leaks, that's a tough environment to work in. So on that one, for example, we were fairly clear. Yeah.
So I don't want to get on this too long, but the Dartmouth General leak, I mean, there were a lot of media attention around the Centennial Building. I don't recall that situation. Could you give us some information on what kind of damage was done to renovated space at the Dartmouth General? I don't recall the government putting out a press release or doing any media on damage at the Dartmouth General because of a roof leak. I mean, that's new to me. I would think it warrants some kind of response from the government. So could you provide us a little bit of information since we didn't get anything from the government?
I don't have more detail than what we've reported in here, because what we were really trying to do was not get into an analysis of why these things happened and are they being done quickly enough. It was more example list. So perhaps asking the department or the health authority for more information would be probably okay. A better route.
Will do.
Okay.
I foresee a news release maybe in my future here on that one. I want to talk a little bit about something that's been an issue for a number of years and that has driven a lot of attention and work done within the Department of Health. I know when I was there, and that's, of course, the overcrowding in the ERs. There's many reasons and many things that contribute to overcrowding in the ER. It can be from H1N1 to high flu season or difficult flu season that you see an influx of people in the ERs. But you mentioned here that many people are waiting for alternative care. Did they give you an indication on what was needed and what the definition of alternative care? Do you have any kind of breakdown on, you know, is it home care or is it long-term care placement? Or did they just say high number of patients that are housed within the hospital setting or the ER are waiting for alternative care? Could you maybe give us a little bit of more detail on if they indicate exactly what that alternative care is and what would help or what was needed to move them from maybe the ER into that alternative care setting?
So we were trying to present here sort of broad issues or broad areas that may be contributing, with the idea being that the department and the health authority should drill down into these issues and get to the underlying issues. So we didn't attempt to sort of, you know, quantify in great detail the numbers around this. It was, you know, organizations were telling us when we visited the 19 hospitals that people waiting to go to a long-term care facility, for example, could be delaying somebody in emergency who may need to be admitted, but there may not be a bed because of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's many factors that contribute to that. Could we say the fact that the current government's decision to put a moratorium, for example, on construction of new long-term care beds be a factor in that? Was that brought up during your visit or during your audit that the number of beds that are available in the province are not going up because of the decision of the current government?
So we didn't sort of do an audit of the long-term care planning on number of beds or look at that. So really we just presented that as one of the issues that was told us without getting into a separate audit of the long-term care facilities.
It would be interesting. I would assume that that will play a role. I know often when we question the government on it, they're quick to turn to the number of people on the list, waiting list, has been reduced pretty much because they changed the criteria, not because there's more beds available. And I know I know that it's not your place to indicate exactly what contributes to those that's overcrowding or what leads to the overcrowding of the ERs, but just wondering if that was something that was mentioned by staff. One of the things that bothers me over the last number of months, especially over the last year, is when we question the government, specifically the minister, on issues in health, the minister seems to often defer his responsibility or government's responsibility to the Nova Scotia Health Authority. We have a new mega health board in the province that oversees health delivery now. What kind of relationship and what kind of responsibility lies within the minister and the government when it comes to, especially the audits and the deficiencies we see? I look at the recommendations and all the responses I see, I believe, I haven't gone through every single one of them, but all the responses that I see has come from the Department of Health and Wellness. Did the Nova Scotia Health Authority respond to any of these recommendations, or was it solely the Department of Health that responded to the audits and the recommendations that you made through the three audits that I see? Well, the two, sorry, deal with health.
So if we look at the hospital system capacity audit, for example, on recommendation 2.1, on page 33, the department responded and the health authority responded as well. If we look at recommendation 2.2 on page 37, both the department and the health authority responded as well. Similar on recommendation 2.3. So generally on this audit, the health authority would have responded to everything.
Looking through it, the Department of Health responded on everything. It wasn't solely the Nova Scotia Health Authority, if I looked through it quickly.
Both responded to each of the recommendations because the recommendations were really written to both.
Yeah. So ultimately, what I read from that would be that the department does ultimately have the responsibility to ensure that the services, that any deficiencies found within delivering the services, is their responsibility. It's not, you can't say it's solely the Nova Scotia Health Authority. Am I wrong in thinking that the responsibility for services and health and deficiencies lie with not solely with the Department of Health, but they're the ones that should ultimately be accountable and responsible as elected officials, as the ministers, but as a government as a whole? Am I reading that? Am I understanding that really should be how responsibility falls within audits and deficiencies that are found through those audits?
So how I see the responsibility here is, on this audit, for example, the audit entities would have been the health authority. So the health authority is governed by, the CEO and executive team and a board of directors that play a role. And the Department of Health would have been the other audit entity as part of this, and they are headed by the deputy minister and then ultimately the minister. The minister would ultimately be responsible for all of it. I mean, the health authority.
Order. I do apologize for interrupting. Okay. Time has expired. We'll move to the Liberal caucus and Mr. Irving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pickup, for your report this morning. Obviously, we've only had a couple hours to skim this as others were speaking, but I wanted to begin by just asking why you've chosen in this report to limit the number of recommendations. We've got a much smaller number of recommendations in this report, and I'll be focusing my questions on Section 2, which has just four recommendations. Could you explain to me why you chose not to go into more detail with the recommendations?
Mr. Pickup.
Sure. So if you look at, for example, recommendations 2.1, okay, so that recommendation really is about developing a plan, and in that plan, discussing locations and what services would be expected. That could have easily been three recommendations. Communicate with Nova Scotians. Develop a plan that addresses locations. Develop a plan that addresses hospitals. So rather than, you know, call something three recommendations, that really is one recommendation. So we focus it in on one recommendation. Similarly, for example, with the mental health patients and the adult protection clients, we made that one recommendation rather than something that says, like, deal with crowding or deal with emergency room waiting for these ones, deal with this issue, deal with this issue. So it's bringing it up a level and grouping it in.
Okay. I have a question on that, but I'll move on just with respect to time. Your report here, particularly in Chapter 2, is really painting a narrative with respect to the need to plan within our healthcare system. Did you find that the department had a very good understanding of that need with respect to how healthcare is changing and the need for a comprehensive plan?
I think what really sticks with me on this audit is that both the department and the health authority fully acknowledge what we are saying here and fully accept the need to deal with these issues. So in clearing the audit and going through the level of detail that is in here, you know, obviously they're running the healthcare system. They know how the healthcare system works, and we were the auditors. So that's what's important to me, is that we were able to demonstrate to them through our audit that we understood what the issues are. We were able to conclude against audit criteria and make recommendations that they wholeheartedly accept and think are relevant.
Yeah, so it's fair to say, I mean, you're obviously not experts in healthcare and healthcare management systems, et cetera. So a lot of your recommendations have really come out of the department's recognition of major shifts needed in healthcare and a much more clear and efficient rationalization of our infrastructure. Is that a fair comment?
So when we do an audit and we have audit questions and audit objectives, we do that, you know, in a number of ways, including interviewing staff, which would have been a big part of this audit. So in visiting 19 hospitals, and, you know, I was out in emergency rooms on some of them as well, and talking with people and looking at reports, then we would have pulled this together. You know, it wasn't the findings, I would say. I won't speak for the department or for the health authority, but I think the findings that we had, it would be fair to say they were well understood and known within the both the department and the health authority.
And the all-encompassing statement with respect to the historic, quoting from your report, the historical ways of planning healthcare to Nova Scotia is not sustainable. That conclusion has been made by you with respect to financial analysis, or has been made in conjunction with, I guess, the understanding of the department of the reality of Nova Scotia's 41% of their budget going to healthcare. Where did that statement come from?
So that would be the overall conclusion of the report, based on things like, for example, looking at the results of patient flow through the hospital and some of the inefficiency and ineffectiveness around patient flow, for example, looking at the infrastructure needs across the system of the health authority's 41 hospitals, and saying, you know, the way of doing things in the past with these 41 hospitals likely needs to be looked at and a plan needs to be developed to say, okay, that's the way we did things before, but what locations do we need now? What are we going to offer in those locations, and how do we communicate that and engage Nova Scotians in that process? So that is how we got to the not sustainable. It is by sort of subcomponents of the audit and answering the audit objectives around each of those key areas that we looked at.
The report talks a lot about the aging infrastructure. Do you have any comments on how long we have been underfunding infrastructure in this province? Clearly, to get to a point in which there are urgent needs identified to the tune of $129 million, that didn't just happen overnight. Can you comment on how bad we've been as a province in terms of maintaining our infrastructure?
So we didn't attempt to do a historical summary of, you know, year-by-year differences between what might have been planned expenditures and what were actual expenditures. You know, we didn't attempt to do that. We indicated what the health authority and the department indicate now as the needs and differences. But again, I would go back to a point we make in the audit that you know, all of these facilities need to be looked at and a plan developed to say, what do you want where? What state do you want that to be in? And then make some of those decisions related to such a plan.
Thank you, because that brings me to I guess, my next point or point that I'd like clarified. In this report, I mean, you know, the glaring chart of $129 million of need that's underfunded by $85 million. Your real point here is not about that number. Your real point here is with respect to the need for a plan. You want to expand I'm on the right track there?
Sure. So just a couple things, you know, I want to clarify that certainly, you know, various infrastructure needs have been presented in the report based on visits to locations. It's not meant to be a complete list. It's not meant to prioritize the list either, but it is meant to point out that while, for example, some of these hospitals with infrastructure needs are well known, some of these facilities are located very close to each other. So if we give the example that we have in here in Cape Breton, where we have three hospitals located within 30 minutes of the regional hospital, some of these hospitals have identified great infrastructure needs. The New Waterford Hospital identified up to $13 million in infrastructure needs that were needed. So what we said is, you have all of these identified infrastructure needs. You know, take a second, take a look and say, okay, before spending all of this money, what do you want to have where? What do you need to deliver health care? So which facilities do you need? How are you going to operate them? What level of service are they going to give? And then do the repairs and maintenance and the work necessary to keep those facilities as you plan on using them. That is a long answer to your question, but that is really the heart of the point. It's twofold.
I agree with you 100% there. I mean, I'm an architect. I know that hospitals are the most complex buildings to plan in terms of understanding the systems and how patients flow, et cetera, and if we're reinventing the system, I would suggest, and I think you're in agreement here, that a very well thought out plan is needed before one runs out and invests in these infrastructures, pieces of infrastructure that we may, you know, in a few months decide, well, that's really not going to fit into a new modern system. I think we're all in agreement there.
I think it would be a shame for Nova Scotians if money was spent, for example, on infrastructure before a plan put in place, and then the plan indicate that based on the planning, we don't need this facility or this facility is going to serve this purpose and not this purpose. And then everybody left shaking their head, and we come along and do an audit to say, you know, why did you spend that money doing this, only to turn around and do this and this and this, right? So I'm not saying, you know, obviously we're the auditors. I'm not saying, for with the example in Cape Breton, what should or shouldn't happen to those four facilities, but I am saying that that should be part of a plan, and the plan should indicate, you know, what you're going to do with all of these facilities. We also give the example of the South Shore and Fisherman's Hospital as well, that need to be considered in terms of what services should be delivered there as well.
And not wanting to try and reach too far here, but based on that, the underspending of a health care infrastructure budget may actually be a sign of stepping back and beginning to do some planning before going forward with various projects.
So I would suggest that a plan would incorporate what facilities you want to have, but it is likely, without prejudging any plan, that you're probably going to keep the regional hospitals, as one of the members pointed out. So if you have, for example, the Cape Breton Regional Hospital with bricks falling off, it's likely that hospital is going to be in your plan. So I think it's a good question for Nova Scotians to ask, why is that infrastructure money not spent to put the bricks on, to keep the bricks from falling off the Cape Breton Hospital, for example. So I don't want to suggest that you wouldn't spend a dollar in maintenance or repairs because you're waiting on the plan.
Understood. Fair enough. I'm just wondering if you would care to comment on the April 21st plan with respect to the announcement of dealing with the VG. My interpretation of that announcement was it was very much on a conceptual level of saying we can now share with Nova Scotians that a complete rebuild at $1.3 billion or whatever is not the route that we're going. So that, in my estimation, was an announcement. We've made a shift. Here's the new idea out there. It was, I think, very premature to be trying to identify a budget to that plan at that point. Would you concur as an auditor that the amount of information there was not at a point in which budget should be set to be tried to adhere to, because the needs were not really fully identified? Is that a fair statement?
Two points I would make on that. One is we did not look at any of the details, so the presumption in your question that information was not available, I would not have any information on that. We did not attempt to gather any information supporting details of what was or wasn't available around the VG site. I mean, we heard about it when it came out in the media first day, so definitely not part of the audit. I would continue to emphasize, though, that a detailed plan with all the specifics needs to be done. And yes, there's a balance between doing that prudently, following good financial management practices, picking up on some of the things that came out of the Blue Nose audit, for example, in terms of, you know, when you announce the budget and doing this type of thing. So yes, recognizing, you know, that there is a balance there, but certainly what's been given to date, as the department's the department acknowledges itself in our recommendation, wouldn't be sufficient to give Nova Scotians what they want or what they need in terms of the information coming. So a long answer to your question, but you know, there are the two facets to it.
Great. So I think in summary, you and the department are in agreement that a plan is urgently needed and it needs to be communicated to Nova Scotians.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to one of my
colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Irving. Mr. McGuire, you have until 11:04.
11:04. Thank you very much. So you said you visited 19 hospitals and ERs. What was your assessment of those hospitals and ERs? Are they overwhelmed? Is every ER, every hospital seeing hundreds of clients every day?
So, the purpose of the visit to the 19 hospitals was a lot of this audit included interviewing staff, reviewing reports at various locations. We did not try to give sub-audit opinions on each of the facilities and say, you know, here are the ones that are working well, here are the ones that aren't working well in terms of detail, or providing a complete and exhaustive list of things that need to be done or challenges. But I would say that these 19 visits, which is a tremendous amount in terms of audit sample, audit coverage, these 19 visits supported comments and conclusions, for example, related to emergency rooms, related to challenges that staff find themselves working in, and those things are acknowledged in the report. So those 19 visits really did allow us and assist us in reaching the conclusions that we did without providing sort of sub-conclusions, if you will. And the 19 hospitals we visited are indicated in the report in terms of breadth of coverage across the province.
I'm probably going to ask you, and we'll see how you answer it, but I'm probably going to ask a question that's not going to be politically popular, but the healthcare system in the last 40 years have been based on bricks and mortar and hospitals. You kind of have been talking around today the amount of infrastructure we have in this province. I'm just going to ask you flat out, do you think that we have too many hospitals in the ERs, not enough, or just the right amount?
So my answer to that would be fairly simple, is that the people who are running these systems, the health authority and the department, they need to figure out what exactly they need, how those needs are going to meet the needs of Nova Scotians for health care, mm-hmm. and then put a plan in place. So, you know, we give examples of proximity of locations, for example. We give examples on infrastructure needs. Those are examples that are all known by the health authority and the department. That's to help share with Nova Scotians some of the issues and challenges facing the health authority and the department to figure out, okay, what services do we provide in hospitals? You know, it may have been one way 40 years ago or 30 years ago, but going forward, what will hospitals provide, both from an efficiency perspective and an effectiveness perspective? There may be things happening in hospitals that don't need to happen in hospitals, but that really is up to the experts who are running these two organizations to figure out what they need, how they're going to implement it, and then communicate and share that with all Nova Scotians.
So to follow up, your job is to look at how taxpayers' dollars are being spent and if they're being spent wisely. The way we have been doing things the last 40 years, the last 50 years, the last 60 years, is that a smart way to continue to spend money into the future? Is it smart to continue to build buildings that by using that money on new buildings, may take away from services that could be provided in other methods and other directions, takes away from doctors? I mean, your job is to look at the money. So is it money well spent?
So I would point out that our job is to look at more than the money. So, you know, healthcare delivery is more than how are you spending the money. Are you delivering the services most effectively? So, for example, for patients needing mental health services, is the emergency room the best place for them, or should there be other alternatives available? But we've been clear, if you look at the overall conclusion, that the department and the health authority must deliver health care more efficiently and more effectively as well. The way things have been working are not the most efficient and effective ways to deliver health care. So we haven't been ambiguous in our overall conclusion, but it is more than just dollars. It is about the type of care you deliver, where you deliver it, and how efficiently you deliver it as well.
And I think we've recognized, I think all parties recognize that there is issues that go back a long way. And if we're going to move forward and change the way for the better that we deliver healthcare system, that we have to do it all as one voice instead of nine separate voices. So with that,
Thank you, Mr. McGuire, and time has just about expired, so we'll move back to Mr. Houston for 14 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the capital spending and the urgent needs versus the budget that was there, could you see any pattern as to which projects got funded at which facilities? Was there any kind of pattern in where the infrastructure upgrades were being made as opposed to where they weren't being made?
So we didn't delve into sort of a history of this classification of infrastructure needs have been done. These ones have been put on hold, either geographically by nature of expenditure. It really was, this is what was shared with us mm-hmm. by the department in terms of the urgent infrastructure requirements.
Okay. Would it be your belief or that kind of analysis would be being done? Like who was deciding which projects to do and which not to do?
So I would suggest when you have the opportunity that question gets posed to the health authority and the department as okay. to how they decide what gets spent where.
Okay. So I guess the obvious question is it part of a plan to close certain facilities that are maybe not getting the capital projects that they're putting on their own urgent list and that are remaining on an urgent list, but you're saying you didn't have that type of information as part of your audit here?
No, and all the more importance, I guess, for that overall plan that we recommend.
So we keep going back to this plan. It would seem remarkable to me if it took the Auditor General to go to senior staff in the Department of Health and say you need to have a plan. But is that really what's happening? There is no plan, and it takes the Auditor General to tell them if you're going to manage this business you should plan for it?
You know, the recommendation that we have indicates in the responses that, you know, work has been started and they're looking at best practices and standards of service delivery. And the engagement with Nova Scotians will take a variety of forms. But I think to date, there's not some comprehensive plan to say, okay, if you take Cape Breton, for example, or the South Shore, for example, here's what's going to be provided in each location. Here's what people can likely expect in terms of service availability. Here's what needs to happen in a hospital. Here's what's not going to happen in a hospital. Therefore, here are the facilities. So this is why we also stress the importance of communication and engagement with Nova Scotians so that mm-hmm. there's not uncertainty or concern or a lot of stress around, okay, what's going to happen when and how.
So you mentioned at least once a time frame of a number of facilities within a 30-minute radius of each other. Is there any magic to 30 minutes? Is that some significant number in healthcare delivery? Or is it just as a reference?
So the 30 minutes was a reference. The standard of care, and Ms. Coleman said, can correct me here if I'm wrong, but the standard of care for emergency rooms, for example, is that 95% of Nova Scotians will have access to an emergency room within 1 hour. Within 1 hour. We use 30 minutes as an example.
So that's the existing policies and procedures stated goal, I guess. Everyone should have access to emergency care within 1 hour.
95% of Nova Scotians will have access to emergency within an hour.
Okay. So can you tell us anything about like everything, like mental health, department's going to do a plan, what services are provided where, departments are going to do a plan. It does seem like these are things that should have been ongoing and had plans in various stages, but is there anything you can tell us? I know you didn't stipulate a timeline as to when these plans should be available, when things should be communicated with Nova Scotians, but I think you said earlier that although you didn't ask or didn't stipulate, the departments didn't offer? Like, we intend to have a plan ready by such and such?
So if I, in fairness to both the department and the health authority, it's not that they weren't aware of any of these issues or that they had issues with providing effective service, right? So if you look at the Nova Scotia Health Authority response to that recommendation, they agree with it. They indicate that a number of initiatives are underway to try to bring appropriate care at the appropriate time by the appropriate provider. They acknowledge they need to build on these efforts, and then they're going to work with their partners to do more, to improve access to various housing, for example. So they acknowledge, and the department acknowledges as well, that they are going to make recommendations to the Deputy Minister of Health and the Deputy Minister of Community Services regarding a collaborative complex needs case management protocol. So it's not like we're telling them things that they aren't already aware of. What we're trying to do is draw attention to it, make the recommendation so that we can follow it up and so that Nova Scotians know where this stands, and that it's not there yet, but it needs to get there. I'd also point out that we are going to do an audit now of the mental health services effectiveness for reporting in spring of 2017.
So would it be fair to say, though, if you had some comfort that these plans were well in hand and almost complete, you wouldn't be making a recommendation that they develop a plan? Am I reading that wrong?
So are you talking in relation to mental health?
I'm actually talking on the
oh, and the,
pretty
and
much,
the big,
pretty
on the
much everything
plan?
This government does. But for today, we'll talk about mental health, sure, and then we'll go through the BG and we can go through them all. But just as a general observation, I'm just wondering, is it the case that if you felt comfortable that there were these plans in being worked on and were close to being finalized, would you still make it the recommendation that they develop a plan?
We would then talk more about where the plan stood. So I think if you look at our overall conclusion, that definitely things need to happen to deliver healthcare more efficiently and effective. We were not satisfied that the bar has been met yet, and so therefore the recommendation to really indicate which services will be delivered in what locations. So that's really when you start to drill down as to what's in a plan, and then the departments and the health authority, they acknowledge themselves and agree with the recommendations and indicate what they're going to do. So I don't think we're not arguing with these two entities over what is or isn't done. They accept what we've said has to happen, and now really it's about how quickly that's going to happen and how successful that is going to roll out.
What are we kind of at the stage of their planning for the planning? Like, do you have any sense of, like, how is there dedicated people in any of these areas that are saying, well, we have 10 staff working on developing a plan, or we have 5 staff, or this is what we're doing. Is there any, or are they still planning for the planning? Like, I'm just really trying to get my head around where this is all at.
So the two responses to that recommendation on page 33 give you a little bit of an indication of that. But my suggestion would be, rather than me trying to sort of speak for the department and the health authority, to invite them in and then have them talk to the details of where they are with this, and probably more importantly, ask them for timelines as to when this is going to get done and how it's going to roll out.
So, and just in terms of process, so the Auditor General says you should really have a plan for this, be it mental health or the VG or something, and then the department says, sure, we're going to develop a plan for this. Is that kind of, what's the back and forth? Like, do you have an opportunity to say, can you put a bit more meat on those bones as to how you're going to, when you're going to, or just is it that when they say, okay, we're going to plan, that's kind of, they write a couple paragraphs on a piece of paper and that's kind of that. Like, I guess, are you satisfied with their response that they're going to do a plan?
So we never attempt to give an advance sort of blessing or ruling, if you will, to say if you do this, that will certainly meet the recommendation, because that is very difficult to do at this stage. So really it's about details, delivery, and rollout. Now, they know well and acknowledge well that this is probably, you know, one of the key priorities that they are facing. So, you know, I certainly believe and hope it's more than the Auditor General coming back in 2 years to follow something up that gives the push to get things done, that it's really driven by the healthcare.
So I guess, do you, like, in the perfect world, would you have more scope to kind of, like, if they're saying they're going to do a plan, that you would actually get to see, well, how are you going to do that, and then have a look at the plan and then kind of sign off if that's a good plan? Like, I think Nova Scotians would be served well for that. Like, obviously, we can see that over 20 years, planning has started and stopped and failed and got us to where we are today. And I'm sure we're at a serious risk of history repeating here with a government that's showing that at the highest levels of cabinet, they don't really know how to plan. And they're probably pushing that down. So I guess, is it good enough for you in terms of that you say develop a plan and they say, sure, we'll develop a plan? Or do you wish you had more scope to kind of dig in to make sure a good plan comes?
So, you know, we have whatever scope we want. The danger to give sort of an advance ruling, if you will, on the response would be that, you know, what if as we go forward that response needs to be tweaked, needs to be changed. What I would hope would happen is that, you know, the role of the Auditor General is to bring attention to these matters, to come to committees like the Public Accounts Committee, who can hold government accountable. So really what I would love to see is this committee bring these two entities in and say, let's talk about where you are with the plan, let's talk about who's doing what, when you're going to have it, what's it going to involve, and that this report is a tool for that step to happen and for the committee to engage these two entities, for example, in a good discussion around this, rather than me trying to sort of speak to planning and the risks and the nature of what will have that. I mean, better you have the people responsible here to talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. Are you finished?
No, I just needed my mic on. Thank you. In terms of the infrastructure spending, did you see any evidence in the course of your audit where there's been any process started to have an inventory of services at the various hospitals and stuff? Like, is there anything that did you see any work papers of anyone saying, well, this is what we do here and this is what we do here, and then look at maybe where the overlap is within that 30-minute window you were referring to? Is that the type of analysis that you were seeing being done by staff?
Ms. Coleman said?
We didn't look at the details of health services planning that's ongoing, because it is ongoing and not completed at this stage. So that wasn't something that we would have gotten into.
Okay, so you would consider that just part of the plan that they're going to do going forward, because I'm just wondering if that was looked at in the context of capital spending, but you're saying no, it wasn't part within your scope, I guess.
No.
Okay. That's good. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. We'll move to Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know through questioning that you've mentioned on a number of occasions that you can't answer some questions because they're more appropriate for the department or the people responsible, I think is what you said, to answer that and appreciate that. One of the frustrating things for myself and for our caucus over the last year or so has been, even when we have those people responsible in front of us, we don't get the answer. And normally the person in front of us is the Minister of Health during question period, during budget estimates. And you know, as we sit here today, I'm still waiting for a response from the minister, for example, on simple questions that I asked during the budget estimates that the minister said he would get back to me on, and we're well over a month since then, if not longer. So I think we're in a time now that Nova Scotians need to understand that the healthcare decisions that affect them has really been handed to a bureaucracy that is not accountable to them. They make key decisions, I think, and they're being made by people who are not elected, who aren't held accountable. And that concerns me, and I know it concerns a number of Nova Scotians. Do you have a response to that? I mean, obviously, the minister has avoided answering direct questions, simple questions, at times. Is there any way for opposition party, for example, as an MLA, to try to emphasize to the government that, you know, ultimately the minister and the premier and the cabinet and the government party is responsible for these services? Is that an observation that I'm on the wrong track, or are you able to comment on that, on the responsibility side of things should lie really with the minister and with the premier and with the cabinet and with the current government? Am I off base by saying that now many of these decisions are being made by unaccountable body like the health authority that we have now in Nova Scotia?
So both of these organizations are ultimately accountable to the Minister of Health. So while the health authority has a CEO and executive, they have a board of directors. The Department of Health has a deputy minister. The Minister of Health ultimately answers to all of it. So the Minister of Health would be accountable to the legislature, to Nova Scotians, and part of the accountability process is the role of the Auditor General to come in. And, we've been fairly clear here that the health authority in the department, needs to do better. They need to deliver health care more efficiently and more effectively. And they accept that. So I think that's part of the accountability. Now, that's only step one, right? What really needs to happen now is these recommendations need to get implemented. So while we're happy that the recommendations have been agreed to, the conclusions have been agreed to, now it's time to get the job done.
So with the recommendations, what kind of balance is there between what you heard from staff, for example? I know on 2.16, you indicated that those working in healthcare may do so in a difficult environment, which may create challenges to providing high-quality patient care. So where's the balance between knowing that there's urgent need and the requirement of a plan for the government to address those? I mean, there has to be, at some point, issues that you found in your report need to be addressed immediately. I know the emphasis is on a plan and we got to do things differently. I understand that, but a lot of things that you recognized, and I mentioned it before, are challenges and deficiencies at regional hospitals, for example, which, you know, there's no foreseeable sea of changing or closing those hospitals down. So where is that balance on those urgent infrastructure needs and the need for a plan?
So I think if you look at the concrete example we gave of the VG, where staff work under very challenging circumstances, you know, leading through this audit would have been, you know, nearly complete before that response or plan from the government on the solution for the VG came out in April. So we were pretty clear that something had to happen to fix these problems at the VG, as one example. But I think, you know, bringing the department and the health authority here and asking them to say, okay, what can you do while you're waiting for a plan on emergency rooms, for example? How do you deal with the crowding and wait times in emergency rooms, recognizing you're always going to have a certain level of emergency rooms, whatever the number is? How do you figure out where the crowding is, where the wait times are, and how do you deal with that? So whether that's people who shouldn't be in an emergency room and should have more appropriate care somewhere else, or various other reasons, a lot of that could probably be worked on while you're waiting to put that other plan in place on location and usage and operation of facilities.
So the talk about needing a plan, and we heard in April the government announced somewhat of a plan to address the Centennial Building. I would think that you wouldn't say that you're going to fix something without looking at what the potential costs are. I remember my time in the Department of Health when we committed as a government to tearing down the Centennial Building and move forward. And there was costs that of estimated costs of a replacement, which was pushing $1 billion at the time, I believe, maybe high $800 million. Would you not think that there are costs that were looked at with the plan that was released? I know it was either on during your audit or just after your audit. I know the government hasn't allocated significant funds in this year's budget for that plan, but would you not think that they should have looked at costs when they released the plan in April about the replacement of the Centennial Building?
So two things on that. I won't comment on what may or may not exist in relation to the solution or plan around that, because I haven't seen it and haven't asked for it, because it really wasn't part of this audit. And secondly, I hope that the government learns from past audits and recommendations we've made in past audits. If we look back to January of 2015, when we reported on the Blue Nose and how when that budgeted number was given, there wasn't a lot of support around that number, and it was probably unlikely that that was ever going to be achieved. So I think it's a balance, but I certainly wouldn't comment on what may or may not exist.
You mentioned on, I think it was page 30, that the Health Authority and the Department of Health need to complete and clear communication that occurs as stakeholders, including the public, to the need to understand how and why changes will be implemented and what services will be available. We've seen on a number of significant issues and potential changes in the past. I'll give an example of the seniors' primary care communications. They didn't get an A for communicating what was going to happen with the changes in seniors' primary care, and we've seen that when more information was provided, that the government made a change, which I applaud them. I'm glad they stopped moving forward on that. So how can the government improve on that communications? Do you give any, are there any recommendations, or is there any examples that you provide the government saying you need to do a better job of communicating to Nova Scotians, especially around healthcare transformation or changes that we'll see into the future that they want to implement?
So it was very important for me as the Auditor General to want to make a recommendation that included on recommendation 2.1 on page 33, that it's very important after following engagement and consultation to tell Nova Scotians what they should expect from their healthcare system. So this would include what services to expect in hospitals, where those hospitals may be located, what they may be used for. Now, the department and the health authority acknowledge themselves what that engagement of communities and stakeholders should look like. So this was critical to us to build into the recommendation so that all of Nova Scotians have the opportunity to be a part of a solution and knowing what they can expect.
In the your Chapter 1 Home for Special Care, it's indicated the number of investigators or compliant officers. I believe in Department of Health there's 9 investigation and compliance officers responsible for some 136 homes for special care, who have a capacity of about 7,000, almost 8,000 residents. And in community services, there are 8 licensing officers responsible for inspecting the homes for 332 homes for special care with a capacity of about 2,200 residents. Your findings of deficiencies in the audit, would you contribute that to potentially the sheer number of facilities that these 9 and 8 officers have to have to inspect? I mean, to me, that seems like a lot. I mean, it doesn't happen. I don't believe it would happen in one day. So even if you broke down 332 homes by eight, it would take you some time to get through all of them. So do you think that may have contributed to some of the deficiencies you see in the inspections and the reporting with the number of homes that these inspectors are overseeing?
So 2 points on that. We do not make a comment on the number of inspectors, but to go to what the audit findings are, community services, for example, they have 332 homes that they are responsible for. And if you look at the findings related to how these inspections are working at community services, it's pretty good results in terms of the audit. You know, they're completing the number, they're timely, you know, they have the guidance. If you look at health and wellness, who have 136 homes, the findings in the audit are really not around the number of inspections carried out, because they carried out the required number of inspections, but it's about not having the information systems available to do reporting, to be more efficient. So the underlying problems here related to these audit results, we certainly don't attribute to the number of inspectors, nor did the entities in their response or meetings indicate that it had to do with the number of people they have.
So I would assume you did speak with some inspectors.
This would have been, this audit would have involved dealing with inspectors, and I myself went out on a couple of inspections.
Would these inspectors, would they have been caught up in the amalgamation or centralization of all the inspectors over to environment, I believe? I know public health inspectors have all moved into one area. Do you know if these inspectors in health and are in that big group of inspectors that they amalgamated, I believe, a year ago or so?
So I'm not sure if they've been amalgamated over when we were really focused on what they were doing. Nobody brought that up in a response. Okay. But if you wanted to confirm with them.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. We'll move back to the Liberal Caucus and Ms. Lonis Croft.
Thank you. I've waited for this report. As you may know, my own mother has been in a long-term care facility for 4 years this month. So I take very seriously what goes on in long-term care facilities. And it's very important to me personally, but also many of my constituents. And we have a demographic in my constituency of an aging population, so care facilities and home care are very significant. And I was really pleased to hear about how the Department of Health and Wellness does complete all its required inspections. Very impressed that you yourself, Mr. Pickup, have gone on some of these inspections, and so it gives you a greater insight of what is actually going on. Did you find any evidence of any inspections not being performed well? You said there's a reporting issue, but I can't with the system. But any performance issues?
Okay, so I'll give you some examples, keeping in mind that the overall conclusion was they do need to do a better job in terms of the consistency of these inspections, and they do need guidance. So to give you an example, as part of our sampling, we would have looked at, in a sample of 30, 127 deficiency reports. So, you know, what in a facility might be deficient. 23 of those 127 deficiencies still existed 5 to 9 months later. So that was not a positive finding. 3 of those were health and safety requirements, including proper medicine storage. And they weren't following up until the next monitoring many months later. And also, as another example, was a facility that didn't test their emergency plan as well. So keeping in mind, this was an audit of the identification and management of health and safety risks, that mm-hmm. health and wellness has a number of things to improve to do a better job on this.
Okay, so were there any indications that any residents suffered harm or injury as a result of a faulty inspection, or?
So when we do these audits and you're looking for control points, you're looking at things that should exist. You do them not because something happened, because they didn't exist. It's about what could happen as a result of a deficiency. So if you have a deficiency like somebody hasn't tested their emergency plan, well, heaven forbid, you may not be able to show that something happened, but what if something did happen and something bad happened and all of a sudden the lesson learned was we didn't test the emergency plan? This is why we do these audits, is to point things out so that we're not after the fact and that you're trying to get control points in place. Same thing with proper medicine storage, right? With that as an example, you know, I can't point to A, B, and C happened as a result, thankfully, but you point these out as key control points that the department themselves realize need to exist. When there are deficiencies and things aren't happening, you have the exposure to something occurring. It's sort of like if you go to the bank and why they might have locks and guards. You know, it's not because somebody stole all the money, it's because you have those controls so somebody doesn't steal the money.
Mm-hmm. So in your audits, in recommendation 1.3 is that service providers establish clear performance expectations and reporting requirements. Did you find, though, within your inspections that there were some facilities that were doing well with that? Because I would think that some boards would have that expectation that there are requirements that their staff have good documentation and reporting.
So we didn't look at the relationship between a facilities board, for example, and management within a facility, some of which these facilities obviously are private sector facilities. What we really looked at was the department's stewardship and the department's ability to overall evaluate how these service providers are doing by having expectations set forth in service agreements that should be in place.
Okay, because I just find at the facility where my mother is, I get regular reports and annual meetings, plus if there's any incident or should my mother fall or anything, I'm called immediately, you know, right. And there's always a follow-up. So I just thought that there may, you know, there is, in some facilities anyway, good reporting that is going on. Also, you know, my mother had to be in a locked unit, so I didn't have the choice of where she went. There are only certain facilities that provide that, and I understand it. But your report identifies that there are some new programs that are very successful in finding new ways of caring for Nova Scotians. So I'd like to hear about those. I mean, they may not fit people like my mother, but they would fit other people. Can you give examples of what are some of the new programs that are out there?
Sure. So one example that I witnessed personally when I was out at a visit with Ms. Coleman Sad at one of the nursing homes is that the physicians and the team were coming to the nursing home, and on this day they just happened to be there on the day we were there, and they were meeting as a team within the facility, and they were meeting with people in the facility, and they were seeing patients that they needed to see within there. So the idea was this would reduce some of the disruption for mm-hmm. the residents. So rather than them leaving to go to an emergency or to go to appointments, the care providers were coming as a team and were meeting as a team within that facility.
Okay, thank you. I'll pass on to my colleague, Mr. Stroink.
Thank you, Mr. Stroink. How much time do I have left?
You have until 11:45.
Okay, great. I'm just going to ask one more question on health care, and then I'll definitely move on to another important topic. I guess you say that hospital-based care is not sustainable and that the services should be moved to community-based settings. You're not the first person to say that, like Dr. John Ross and others have been saying this recently in the paper and stuff. Do you feel that healthcare in Nova Scotia is already moving in that direction?
So So the overall conclusion, I think, you know, we have to stick to what the overall conclusion is, that, you know, we don't feel things are currently being efficiently and effectively managed as they could be, and therefore the need to get down and look. Now, we do acknowledge that there are some things that are working well, like we give an example of a hospital trying to keep people in their home and not in the hospital waiting a long-term care facility.
So we're sort of already sort of started that path. I mean, there's lots more work to be done on that for sure, but I think we're headed in the right direction. So thank you very much for that comment. I guess what I do want to touch base on, since I have a few minutes left and it hasn't been touched on, is the species at risk. You know, you discussed, I think you mentioned, or I'll ask you, you said in another area, but you said that this has never really been looked at before by the Auditor General. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
So looking at that, and I think this has been an ongoing problem for many, 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 many years. I think all level, all government, all parties have their fingers in this issue at some point along the way and then have not looked at it or taking it seriously. Is that a fair assessment to say?
I would stick to the conclusion made in the report that there are 60 species at risk and this needs to be a greater priority for the government.
And I guess that's where I'm happy to see that the Department of Natural Resources has committed to October 31st, 2016 to put most of these five recommendations into a plan. Is that correct?
Keeping in mind, that I like that they put a date in there of October 16, but it's not that everything is going to be completed. It's that they've identified there may be plans in place, things may be set up. So some of these things are going to take longer than that. But certainly I would give, you know, the department a thumbs up, if you will, on trying to put a tangible date around when they want to do something.
And I guess that's where they're starting to ramp it up, and I'm happy to see that. And I guess, you know, looking at some of the issues of the species that are at risk, you know, recovery plans for five of the threatened or endangered species are late by 6 months. So they're not 6 months to 7 years. So I guess I'm going back to that indicates that this has been an ongoing issue for many, many, many years. And I think that's a fair assessment to say.
I think if something is 7 years late, that means, you know, 4 years ago, it was 3 years late.
Yeah. Fair point. The other thing that I wanted to touch on with my limited time here, looking back in 2013, there was an increase of 19 species were added to the list of provincial species at risk. Why was there such a jump at that time of the 19 species? I mean, is it human interaction within our protected areas? Is it global warming? Like, what are some reasons for that? Because that's a big jump.
Mr. Pickup?
So we haven't gone into the detail of why they were added in 2013. So
yeah.
Perhaps you can ask if you have a chance to ask the department, because we didn't look at why those were added.
Okay. Fair enough. And I noticed that you've also mentioned the invasive species that have direct impact onto these species. Was there more in-depth look into that from your department, how the government is trying to deal with those, especially like the green crab?
No.
Okay. One of the topics that we've talked a lot about, or we've heard a lot about in the past, was the tricolored bat. And I see that that's on the endangered species list. Did you look at or had an opportunity to see specifically what kind of a plan they are doing for that species at risk?
Ms. Coleman said?
We would have looked at recovery and management plans for certain of the species. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you which species they were. And we would have been looking to see that there was a recovery team, that the recovery team developed a plan, and that the department either, like, assessed that plan, decided to make some changes, or decided certain areas weren't appropriate. So we would not have the expertise to look at the plan and say, that's an appropriate plan or not. We'd be looking at the processes that they had to develop the plan.
Okay, thank you. And I guess also one thing I just need some clarification on is that endangered species fall under provincial, but they also fall under federal jurisdiction, if that's a fair assessment to say. Of this report, was there any looking at the federal responsibility within the species of risk for Nova Scotia?
Ms. Coleman said.
So some of the species are listed federally, some are only listed provincially, some are listed both. So some of the plans that we looked at, there is work going on with the feds in instances where it is joint, and the Provincial Endangered Species Act does provide for that. So the extent of what we would have done, because obviously we don't have any jurisdiction to look at what the federal government is doing, we would have looked for those plans where species were listed jointly and there was a joint plan, then we would have looked at that plan. In some instances, that would have meant slightly different criteria or things involved in the plan because the federal legislation might be different. Provincial legislation allows for that, so that would have been okay.
Great. How much time?
Just another 20 seconds remaining.
It's a very large topic for discussion, I think, and a very important one. So I do thank you guys for taking the time to look at endangered species as sometimes they are forgotten. So I do greatly appreciate the work that you've done on this area.
Thank you, Mr. Stroink. The time for questioning has expired. Mr. Pickup, I'd like to offer you an opportunity to provide some closing comments.
Sure. I want to thank members today for their interest in these three critical areas impacting Nova Scotians. I want to thank Ms. Coleman-Saad for leading the performance audit practice and leading the teams that did these three audits. And I want to thank people who are back in the office, who are busy working on other audits, but may have this on their screen and watching the Public Accounts Committee work as well. They take these audits very seriously, as you can tell, and the passion for which our auditors have as they visited these 19 hospitals, for example, is tremendous. They do this work mainly because they care. They have a lot of options to go a lot of other places, but they continue to pursue this work and to make recommendations to improve things for Nova Scotians. We do this work and we give this report to you as a tool to hold the government accountable. So whether it's the delivery of healthcare, which impacts every Nova Scotian within the province, or whether it's health and safety risks for the 10,000 Nova Scotians that are in these homes for special care. They're very much relying on the work that we do and then the work that you do to hold the government accountable and make the recommendations get implemented. So if we're talking things like deficiencies and seeing that the government acts upon these things, it is just so important. And when I got out and visited homes for special care on the community services side and on the long-term care facility side, you know, when you're there with people who are, this is where they live day to day, you see firsthand how much they're counting on a public service and a government that is working well and delivering efficient and effective care, because that is their home. That's where they wake up and that is where they go to sleep. So very, very important. I was glad to get some questions on species at risk as well, because these are critical to our way of life. Whether it's the economy, whether it's our ecosystem, whether it's tourism, once these things are gone, if they're not conserved and managed properly, it will be too late. Some of my work in getting ready on the species at risk, one of the things that I learned is gone from Nova Scotia is the woodland caribou, for example, that's on the quarter. So we no longer have the woodland caribou in Nova Scotia. While it exists in other provinces, it is extirpated within Nova Scotia. So species at risk is as important to us as any of these topics are. And while it might not get necessarily the same level of attention as hospitals do, part of the reason why we pick this is because it is so interrelated. to our economy and into our way of life and what we expect. So, you know, we don't want to wake up someday and say, you know, why are all of these things like the turtles no longer here? You know, this is a chance for now for government to take these recommendations and do something about it. So it's a long conclusion to a what was a three-hour meeting, I guess, with a two-hour public session. But I want to thank you and wish you all a great summer and see you in September.
Thank you, Mr. Pickup, and Ms. Coleman-Sad as well. And please pass our thanks along to those working in your offices who have contributed to this report. It's very important, and we thank you for all of your work. We do have some committee business. We have correspondence. I'm going to go through them one by one. We have correspondence from school boards, including Strait Regional School Board, Halifax Regional School Board, and Chignecto Central Regional School Board. Those were all in response to questions we had asked during a May 11th meeting. And we also had correspondence from the Department of Education related to that meeting. Are there any questions related to that correspondence? Seeing none, we'll move to we had correspondence from a Ms. Pickings. This was something that was discussed by our subcommittee. And this letter was directed to the Office of the Ombudsman. It was copied to our committee. The decision of the subcommittee was that we would acknowledge that the letter had been received, that we were copied on it. There was no further action taken than that. However, we do want to get the opinion of the full committee. Are members satisfied with the approach that we've taken there? I'm seeing agreement. Okay, our clerk will take note of that. We have an opportunity for training with the CCAF, and I believe everyone has a copy of, or has been provided with a copy of the modules, the training modules that they offer. And I'm going to raise this as a, we will need to come to a decision regarding this if we wish to have the training. So you have been provided with the information. We do need to make a decision. I'm not asking that we make that decision today, but is there anybody who wishes to comment on the correspondence we received from CCAF? Hearing no comments, and I would continue to encourage people, if you see something here that you feel will benefit the committee, to raise it by email to our clerk. We will have the opportunity to schedule something in early fall. That's probably the best time, perhaps before the House begins to sit. So I encourage people perhaps to look at it now and to get their thoughts going now so we can start to prepare to ask them to come to visit if we so choose. So that is something we will revisit. Our next meeting will be September 14th. We have not scheduled a witness yet, but we do have witnesses approved from the subcommittee and from the full committee here. So we will be aiming to meet again on September the 14th. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.